This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
I am joined here by Frank, Tom, and Jill, members of the local Portland branch of the Industrial Workers of the World. We are here to talk about the relevance of the IWW in labor history, its continued presence in the labor movement, and the meaning of May Day. Thanks for joining us, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I want to start a little bit about hearing some of your how y'all got into the IWW, what it meant for you as a worker when you were presented with this opportunity to join. Tom?
Well, I grew up in the south side of Chicago. Both my parents are in AFL-CIO unions. For me, radicalism was not so much a product of any specific theoretic initially, though that came later, but it became more of a product of seeing the situations my parents were in and understanding that despite the fact that their unions gave them a lot of rights in their workplaces and in specific situations, other jobs, for instance, my father worked as a programmer, did not, and were also unrepresented by a union. But on top of that, the unions they were in did not seem to really – they seemed to always seem to have complaints about them, and it seemed to me like if it was an organization that was supposed to have solidarity through and through, that it would have been something that they would have had a lot less at least complaints, not to say none. And so for me, finding something like the IWW, doing my own research, it just seemed like it was a great fit, seeing its history. But more importantly, at the time, being like 2005, 2006, seeing some of the campaigns that were really hitting across the country, and then further on seeing things like the retail workers stuff that was happening in Minneapolis with Jimmy John's and Starbucks out in New York, really made me realize, being a retail worker, that it was something that could represent me and that it was something that was still very relevant.
Well, we are we started off hearing an intro to the classic documentary about the Wobblies called The Wobblies. Wobblies is a term possibly of derision. It's been taken on affectionately over the years to refer to members of the IWW. And that film was made back in the 70s or around 1970. And I know a lot of members of the IWW look at this as a great film. It's, you know, the Wobblies in this popular venue, and at the same time, it reinforces this idea that the IWW was something that happened a long time ago, and that it's really just a historical club for old white guys. And that's why I'm glad to have Jill on, who is a member of the Patriarchy Resistance Committee. And you know, one of the things that I think, and that I hope you can speak to, Jill, makes the IW different than a lot of other unions is the way that it puts oppression and anti-oppression work into its idea of what it means to organize the working class. Do you think you could say a bit about your experience in that work?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the union is unique in the fact that, you know, in its history, it's never had any rules about who is allowed and who's not allowed to be in the union. Everybody was allowed to be in the union. And I think now, you know, a lot of the work is being focused on how to make the union more inclusive. And that means, you know, training our organizers to know, like, what those needs are of workers and how to listen intently about those needs and to be able to take action. You know, maybe the biggest problem at a workplace isn't wages. Maybe it's sexual harassment. And so having, you know, people in the shop who are aware of those kind of dynamics is really a benefit, I think, to the entire union.
You are listening to Political Perspectives. I'm your host, Joe Clement. I'm joined with members of the IWW. If you would like to call in to ask questions about the IWW, about May Day, to voice your concern about, you know, where unions should be going, but maybe you feel they aren't, call in at 503-231-8187. Frank, why don't you tell us what you do and how the IWW has been important for you?
I guess most recently I've been involved in the what's called the General Organizing Committee, which is a group of workers, is essentially for workers in industries that don't have a large representation otherwise in our branch, and for people that are in industries that are largely represented, but they can't, they don't, their schedule doesn't work with the current meeting structures and times of the industrial organizing committee that they're a part of. So so what we do in the General Organizing Committee is generally we have reports. We meet once a month and we have reports from everybody's workplace to discuss what's been going on there, if there's been any progress. We have question and answer kind of sessions, focused question and answer sessions with people at the, about their different workplaces to try to help formulate new ideas about how to move forward, how to be talking with other coworkers. How to like pick out how to you know find the common points of interest amongst all the workers in a particular place so that everybody can better organize. So it's very useful for learning about how to organize and take direct action.
And that's one of the kind of public services and services to the working classes that the IWW offers is an organizer training, which we have monthly. We also have an introduction class, or not monthly, but every few months. We also have an introduction class that's going to be coming up on the 19th. If you go to the Portland IWW website, just portlandiww.org, there is a sign-up sheet that you can look at and, you know, give us an idea of if you want to come. We will be providing food and snacks. It's where we explore the idea of solidarity unionism, the use of direct action, and how the IWW differs from business and trade unions. And I guess I'd like to turn to that and ask y'all about direct action and why you think that comes to the fore in the IWW and why we should be bringing that out in the labor movement generally.
I think direct action is important. It's like the saying, we don't want just a slice of the pie, we want the whole bakery. So kind of taking that concept, it's not just about, you know, immediate gains and wages and, you know, healthcare and all those things. It's more, which I guess is maybe a little hard to grasp for a lot of people, but, you know, you can actually have agency in your life for change. And coming at it with an anti-capitalist perspective, you know, kind of opens that up. And I think it's super important.
I mean, for me, direct action is very relevant to something that holds itself as a movement. I feel like the IWW still holds that movement. It still holds like a broader end goal. Industrial unionism in itself predicates an idea that workers like all over are going to move forward. If you, again, look going back to what I was saying earlier, despite my absolute respect and solidarity with the rank and file of trades unions and business unions, I find that the bureaucracy of those unions over the last 20, 30 years, if not longer, has reached a point of stagnancy and becomes more of an intermediary between capital and workers. The IWW doesn't want stagnancy. It wants to move. It wants movement. And the way that that happens is via organizing. A term we saying we have is organizing the worker, not the work. I mean, you have a lot of people in itinerancy there in the IWW. I mean, they get into the union and they become organizers in themselves via our training. And they move forward with that grouping of people, regardless of their job, toward a larger and larger movement that hopefully one day will bring about a revolutionary change in our society, that will be a change for democracy, that will be a change that actually predicates people living lives that they are under control of rather than lives that are told to them how they're going to be run and frankly stolen from every day by a management and expropriating class of people that says they deserve to have more than everyone else because of frankly many arbitrary and privileged I suppose, nature of their being. So that's to me, like, for me, direct action is what you need for that. You need something that's not just about like, oh, we're going to elect, you know, elect for this e-board, you know, elect for this group of people that are then going to be inherently conservative, that are going to allow for us to just sign a contract so we can just all exist as a union forever. I mean, ideally, one day the IWW just becomes the neighborhood committees and councils that, you know, run our you know, run certain parts of, like, the world or the country, perhaps not all of it. I mean, one big union to me can mean many things. It doesn't have to be the only game in town, but it could definitely be a model and a possibility for the future. And direct action, doing things oneself, going forward as workers in solidarity, and directly changing the things in the world, in the workplace and otherwise, to me is the only way that we can have that movement. It's the most democratic way to do work as well.
You use that phrase, one big union, and it's kind of one of the core principles that has been with the IWW since the beginning. It's actually kind of like a concept and strategy. I was wondering whether any of you would like to speak at to where the one big union is showing up in the world today.
That's a pretty broad question.
Well, I guess what I mean is where do you see the labor movement outside of the IWW picking up towards, you know, working classes, seeing themselves as a class again and not just as divided industries?
I mean, I guess more. I'm not sure if this answers the question exactly, but you're starting to see housing justice work tied in with directly with wage labor issues because, you know, more and more there are masses of people that have very little to no work and therefore have severe housing issues. So like more commonly now people can identify themselves as having the same problems that go far beyond what kind of work they do, but goes into the depths of their daily lives. And so I think that that's something that's really important. I mean, within the IWW, something that I really appreciate about our union and our branch specifically is that we have a really tight community of people. So when somebody is in need of housing, we help find housing and find support for that person or group of people to get what they need. The same goes for work. The same goes for sick pets, which happened in my case. It's kind of anything, you know. We support each other as a community in ways that are far beyond just the workplace, which is exactly where we need to be going, I think, in the long run.
Well, we're going to take a musical break for a minute. Maybe we will talk about dumping the bosses off your back. You're tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. I'm your host for this special May Day Political Perspectives Hour. We are talking with members of the Portland IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World. We just heard Anne Feeney singing a classic IWW song that she also added some lyrics to called Dump the Bosses Off Your Back. And, you know, that is probably one of the toughest things for a lot of workers to swallow is the really agitated, confrontational stance of the IWW. But, and, you know, there's lots of reasons that people feel attached to the people they work with, even their bosses in certain respects. But why is having that consciousness that the working class and the employing class don't have some fundamental interests in common important to the IWW's way of organizing?
Because we don't have anything in common. And when I guess when Wobblies talk about not having anything in common with their bosses, it's not like, oh, my boss has a kid, my boss also likes the Timbers, you know, these things that, like, on some kind of social level you do have in common. But at the same time, your boss can fire you at any moment. Your boss can take away your livelihood at any moment. You can't do the same to that person. As a worker. So at the end of the day, you know, they get pressure from up top if you are quote unquote out of line or for any reason whatsoever, and they can just send you packing, right? So while you might have thought that you had a close relationship with your boss, that can turn at any moment and you can be gone. So it's important to always keep that in mind that, you know, like while you might be friendly with your boss is not your friend.
I mean, and building off of that, I mean, people talk, you said the word consciousness, and I think you have a lot of people, especially in some of the more academicized, you know, political spheres out there that say, you know, consciousness is this really specific set of ideas. It's really like specific wordage. It's really specific like in like what it signifies. I mean, the IWW is not a political organization. It's political in that it obviously seeks to make change in the world, if that's your definition of political, but it's not political in a manner of like our rhetoric is taken out of textbooks. Our rhetoric is that of like, you know, the intellectuals. I mean, yeah, there's definitely an intellectual character to a lot of working class people, to all working class people. But for us, consciousness, and for me certainly, is something like you talk about the not having anything in common with your boss and the working class having anything in common with the employing class. To me, that's just something that people, if you really sit down and look at your situation in a workplace, you see it. I mean, you see it when your boss is a buddy to you one day and really is being nice or whatever. And then the next day is like, you know, your job's expendable because my upper management says so. And I mean, even if you're buddies with upper management, same thing. It's like, I mean, it's not that people are inherently these like devils and like are not naturally a part of like the employing class or the working class. It's something that's been socially created. And so what you have are people who are following their roles to a T and are like doing their job as oppressors in our society because they refuse to question that. And I'm not going to pity them. What I'm going to, who I'm going to have support for are the people that they're affecting negatively. And the way that they're acting has absolutely nothing in common with the way that working people are acting. It's not about their quality as individuals outside the workplace. It's about their economic behaviors that they try to pretend are like benign or at least, you know, fair. And in reality are based upon a very system that steals out of people's pockets for the work they do. Like I was saying earlier, for a system that allows for the least democratic, you know, distribution of like resource imaginable. I mean, we hold everything up that's above us as working class people. And they all just do what they want, and they say that they have more expertise. But, you know, in the words of an elder woman who was working in a factory in Argentina after they took the factory over in the 90s, well, you know, the bosses always said it was so hard to do all this management work and all this accounting, but, you know, we took over the books. It really doesn't seem that hard at all. I mean, it's this myth. It's this myth of expertise that exists in our society that the very people who do the work have no idea what they're actually doing, which, if you really think of it that way, is insane. So...
I like the way that you put that, Tom, that, you know, it's not really people's personal agendas that are necessarily hurting people. It is the way that they take on these prerogatives and don't question them. And you see that come up when you hear boss types or board members talking about, you know, financial need, the need to, you know, act in the best interest of the big pile of money that a lot of organizations sit on top of, and that, you know, that requires tough changes. And that, you know, makes me want to remind KABU listeners that there are important changes going on at KABU right now. And we're having a special membership meeting on the 4th at Tabor Space. That's at about 55th and Belmont. It's going to start at 1 p.m. not sure how long it's going to go, but our executive director and boss, Lynn Finch, is going to be presenting her plan for regenerating KABU. And it is going to be very important for KABU members to come there and participate in the conversation that can be had in this forum. We're going to go to another musical break right now. A wonderful woman named Grace Parker rewrote a contemporary song, Single Ladies, called Union Ladies.
Cards up, up in the job, trying to hold up. I'm doing my own little thing. My boss is a jerk and I'm doing all the work. My assistant worker approaches me. She's tired of being screwed. She says she's through. She said, let's start a union. I said, sounds nice, like good advice. Now we got some organizing to do. So if you like it, then you should sign a card on it. So if you like it, then you should sign a card on it. Don't you worry about your boss and what he say about it. Cause if you like it, then you should sign a card on it. Oh, 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 oh. Boss is on a power trip. My wages look like so as workers we are organizing. Of everything they sold in our workplace, they will soon be free. We need no permission, did I mention? Don't pay the boss any attention, cause he had his turn, and now he's gonna learn that his workers have solidarity. So if you like it, then you should sign a card on it. So if you like it, then you should sign a card on it. Don't you worry about your boss and what he say about it. Cause if you like it, then you should sign a card on it.
You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. I am your host for this Political Perspectives Made a Special, where we are talking with members of the local industrial workers of the world. So industrial is a word that I think makes a lot of people think, you know, factories of old and a certain kind of work style that we don't really have as much anymore. But I know that the IWW has a much more expansive sense of the word industrial. And I was wondering, Jill, could you tell us a bit about industrial organizing and what that means in the context of what we're doing today in the very different work environment of old industry?
Yeah, definitely. I think what you hit on is totally correct. People hear industrial and they say, well, I don't work in an industry. I work at, you know, a Walmart or something like that, you know, which actually would be retail. Retail is an industry. I think the best way I like to explain it is that industrial organizing is like, you know, take Starbucks, right? So, you know, the trade unions will say, we're going to organize all the baristas. Everybody who pours coffee, we're going to organize them. You know, and then another trade union says, well, we're going to organize all the cash register people. You know, and then so you have an action where the baristas say, well, we want a dollar raise. And so they go on strike. You know, and then the cash register attendants have to come in and basically cross the line. And where we say we want to organize a whole shop and we want to organize, you know, every single worker in that shop, in that industry. And so I think that's a kind of clear way to explain that difference.
I think it's also important to note why when people – because you think about it just like straight on and you look up the term industrial or industry. It doesn't necessarily mean just heavy industry. I mean, but what it comes down to – and this also plays into what Jill was saying about, you know, why like the trade unions organizing by specifically the trade versus industrially. I mean, it was about organizing skilled labor, and they wouldn't touch – I mean, traditionally, the AFL did not touch anything that was, like, considered by them to be unskilled labor. And that's why people, I think, even rhetorically to this day, the terms like industrial came out largely from, like, this rhetoric that came amongst working people of, like, what is industry and what isn't industry. And a lot of times it was you know, decided by what was going to be organized and what isn't. So when you think of – industry, you think of heavy industry, because those are like, you know, stamping trades. Those are like, you know, trades that like are considered like, you know, like welding and stuff like that, which are obviously very important things, but are considered to be like the only things that are industries, and everything else is just like just some jobs, like, you know, and it's some jobs. And I think it created this hierarchy, which I'm very sure that, like, you know, Sam Gompers, the founder of the AFL, would have absolutely, you know, said, yeah, like, it's, there is a hierarchy, you know. To us, there's not that hierarchy. To us, it's not about, like, yeah, it's not organizing the work, it's organizing the worker. It's not about, like, let's have this thing where, like, the skilled workers, as if, like, only those jobs require skills, are going to just have what they have, and then everyone else can just, like, you know, flounder wherever they're going to be. To us, it's like, you know, every single worker in every single trade, every single industry deserves representation, deserves democracy in their lives, deserves liberation. So, I mean, that plays in with that, too. It's like, why do we not consider those industries? Well, it's because this false hierarchy has been created on top of it. Similar to, like, why do we not consider work at home to be work, you know? It's because it's not paid, because it's not, like, you know, by our current system. And it's like, you know, the system's a patriarchy that say, oh, that doesn't count, you know, because often it's women doing that work. So I just thought to add to that, because Jill's right on, you know, it's just, you got to think about why people don't consider these things industry. Why do they say, oh, it's not, I don't work in an industry. I pour coffee drinks.
Yeah, I think that it's important. You bring up the AFL-CIO and the IWW's tension with that group goes way back, you know, to the very beginning, even before it was the AFL-CIO, and it was just the AFL, the American Federation of Labor. And it was much more common than to have, quote-unquote, unionized groups of workers scabbing on other workers in industries where they shared enough of the skills that they could come and pick them up. And while it may have been much more rampant then, it still really hasn't gone away. And I think the best example that listeners can think to today is what's been going up in Longview with the longshore workers who initially were, you know, looking at having the International Brotherhood of Operating Engineers, a union, scab on them for the EGT company that wanted to, you know, find maybe face value union cred and saying, well, we still hired union workers, but you hired union workers to, you know, undercut the power and the jurisdiction of those original union workers.
And the same thing happened here at the Port of Portland a couple months ago, where the refrigeration units were handed over to the IBEW from the ILWU. You know, in the whole, clearly there's a function of this that the bosses have in mind. You know, they're like, yeah, like Joe said, you know, we're still hiring union workers, but the whole purpose is to divide workers along lines. And it's a really effective, I mean, everybody's heard the divide and conquer. Well, that's the idea. You know, you agitate the workers against themselves so that you can just destroy it, instead of workers being united, which is why organizing industrial is much more important. It doesn't matter if you're working on electrical stuff, if you're a welder repairing the hull of a ship, or if you're loading and unloading a ship. If you're working in a dock, you're in the same industry, and you should be in the same union together.
There's actually a really great song that we have on file to play that is exactly about this. Engineer Kurt, could you bring up Casey Jones?
The workers is on the ESP line to strike Senator Carr. Casey Jones, the engineer, it wouldn't strike at all. His boiler, it was leaking. His driver's on the bone. And his engine and his bearings, they were all out of plumb. Casey Jones, he kept his jump out running. Casey Jones, he was working double time. Casey Jones, he got a wooden medal for being good and faithful on the ESP line. The worker said to Casey, won't you help us win the strike? But Casey said, let me alone, you better take a hike. Then Casey's wheezy engine ran right off the worn-out track. Casey hit the river with an awful crack. Casey Jones, he hit that river bottom. Casey Jones, he broke his blooming spine. Casey Jones became an Angelino. He took a trip to heaven on the ESP line. When Casey got to heaven right up to the pearly gates, he said, I'm Casey Jones, the guy that pulls that UP freight. Well, you're just the man, said Peter, our musician's on strike. You can get a job of scabbing anytime you like. Casey Jones, he got a job in heaven. Casey Jones, he was doing mighty fine. Casey Jones went scabbing on the Angels, just like he did to workers on the ESP line. And they said, this isn't fair for that Casey Jones to go around always scabbing everywhere. Well, the Angels Union 23, they sure were there, and they promptly fired Casey down that golden stair. Casey Jones, he went to hell a flying. Casey Jones, where the devil said, oh, fine. Well, Casey Jones, get busy shoveling sulfur. That's what you get for scabbing on the ESP line. That's what you get for scabbing on the ESP line.
You are tuned to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland. The time is 9:36. I'm Joe Clement, your host for this Political Perspectives Made a special about the industrial workers of the world. I'm joined by Frank, Tom, and Jill. So the IWW has, you know, been actively organizing workers for all 107 some odd years of its existence, and there is a pretty active branch organizing workers in Portland. I know some of you have been involved in some of those campaigns. You want to tell us about recent successes?
So recently, members of the IWW, as well as members of We Are Oregon, which was and is currently until very soon a subsidiary of SEIU, there was a contact we got via of some folks at a shop called Yaw's Top Notch. It's a restaurant that's out on the Far East Side, and there was wage theft claims. There's a lot of issues, and we came together using models of direct action support, but more importantly, empowering these workers to take the lead in these delegations of the letter deliveries and putting a pressure. And it was what really happened was a pretty tidy, like, frankly, short campaign where the owners capitulated pretty fast to the demands. It was well organized. It really was a good coordination of us and rank and file organizers within the We Are Oregon SEIU group, and workers were brought to the fore and were able to develop their own strategy, which further empowered them and meant for a lot of participation. And it was a success. It was a success in our model, and it was a success that was I feel very not self-serving to the organizations. I mean, the organizations should be about the workers, and we didn't do this just so we could sign a shop up so we could get another contract of dues paying members. This was just about supporting people in the community who had been wronged and coming forward as allies to them and being like, hey, we have resources if you want them at our disposal. Let's do this. And like I said, we worked with some folks from SEIU. And I want to before the break, music break, we talked a little about of our criticisms of the AFL-CIO. And I want to make it very clear again, and I said this earlier, the IWW does not have a position in any way, shape, or form against the rank and file members of the AFL-CIO. We have many folks who are dual cards, who are involved in both unions, both the IWW as well as in other unions. We have some people who are tri-cards, who are involved in two other unions. We don't have a policy against dual carding or tri-carding, et cetera. To us, it's not about that, and it's not about antagonizing directly to rank and file. Our issues with those models is that we feel that the leadership of those organizations tend to be inherently conservative, and it's due largely to their model not wanting to make systemic change, but rather to try to directly interact with material, which is great and important, but then kind of stop there. And then you see a lot of situations where you have the executive boards of unions holding back membership wanting to vote. I mean, how many times have you heard about membership wants to vote for a strike? And the board goes, no, that doesn't make sense right now. And it's who knows better, the people on the floor, the people in the office. And I think it's important to remember that, because I don't want anyone listening to our show today to think that we have any issue with them being involved in any kind of union, because I'm all about any worker being a part of any kind of collective bargaining that makes their lives better. It's just one other step toward a bigger picture to me.
I like to remind listeners that this is a call-in show. You can call in to talk to us about your workplace experiences if you want, to ask us questions, to chime in to our agitated but hopeful messages at 503-231-8187. I definitely agree with you, too, and I should give some full disclosure. I'm also a member of the Industrial Workers of the World. I've gotten through them, found out about them really through their music, and it was a very kind of interesting transformation, because I too also had this idea that the IWW was maybe still around, but not really, an active organization. And really in the last, I think, 10 years, as I've come to learn more about the organization, it's been picking up a lot. And one of the campaigns that really put the IWW back on the map was its effort to organize Starbucks workers. And it has really kind of, I think, led the way in advancing the idea that the regular retail workers' jobs that, we might call crap jobs are places where people actually make a living.
I mean, I guess more importantly, those are jobs that need to be – those are workers that need to be organized. They're the ones that are at the bottom of the pile that hold the rest of it up. And they're also the ones that historically for the last 60 or 70 years – no union has made any real attempts to organize. It's a very difficult thing to organize because those are the most expendable workers according to their bosses. So they tend to float from one place to another, which is why it's all the more important to remember that as the IWW does, it's important to organize the worker, not the workplace, because if that worker gets fired or leaves that one job for whatever reason, they're going to go to another job. And they're probably going to have very, very similar problems at the next job they go to, regardless of whether they're doing the food service stuff here or, shop floor retail in another place. They're going to have pretty much the same issues anywhere they go, and they're going to face the same stuff, the same kind of organizing problems. So if you have the worker organized, then they can take the education somewhere else and do the work somewhere else, and it doesn't matter. And the more people like that are floating around, the harder it becomes for bosses to push workers around at any given place. You kind of establish a pattern of resistance amongst the working class, little by little, that can build and really push back hard.
Well, we have a caller on the line. Sean, thanks for joining us, Sean. What would you like to say or ask?
Hey, good morning. Joe, you've been doing some excellent work on the Old Mo show about guaranteed basic income and like things like guaranteed food stamps for all. You know, it seems like we're in an ecological crisis, and we're also in an economic crisis in terms of the poor and working class of the country. And I was wondering if you and your guests today could talk about the possibility of things like degrowth, actually shrinking the size of the economy while simultaneously improving the quality of life and the standard of living of the American people, things like shortening the work week and stuff like that. I was wondering if you guys could talk about that, because from my perspective, it seems like we have to have some sort of economic central planning to do that, but I know that runs against the IWW's thinking, so I just wanted to get your response to any of that. Thanks.
Thank you, Sean. I think that it's great that you point out the shortened work week as, you know, an important way of thinking through the kinds of changes that we need to ultimately be fighting for. On the last show that you heard, Lisa Loving made the remark that May Day was founded around an anti-war type event, and as well-meaning as that was, it's actually the eight-hour day that was the kind of the founding concern that brought about May Day well over 100 years ago, when workers were finally starting to organize in a industrial national way to bring down 10, 12-hour workdays to an eight-hour week. And when a group of anarchists were blamed for a bombing in a square, Haymarket Square, they were hung, and that from that day on, or from those years on, May 1st was inaugurated as International Workers' Day. Do you want to add something, Frank?
I was going to get a note regarding the caller's comments and question that shrinking the economy is an interesting idea, because I think a lot of people have kind of – it's easy to have a misconception of what the economy actually is, because all that we're ever presented with is these ideas that, oh, growth. The U.S. has had 2.5% growth this year. What does that mean? I mean, my wage didn't go up 2.5%. Did your wage go up 2.5%? Probably not. Probably not. If anything, you might have got a 1% raise. I got told that my raise, whatever raise I might get, got pushed back 6 more months. So that's a negative increase in my wage. And I think that's pretty standard practice. But the point is, like, we all together produce way more than we actually need, but we just don't get our share of it. So we can reduce the total amount of stuff we produce if we just are producing it for ourselves because we make it. We should have control of it because it's our stuff. And that way we can actually come down to a point that's have a reasonable economy, a reasonable level of production that isn't exploiting workers, that isn't exploiting the environment that we live in, that we all rely on in the long term.
We got another caller. Leslie, what would you like to say or ask?
Hi, good morning. I'm a student who does temporary work in the healthcare industry, and I wanted to ask about unionization and temporary workers. I'm wondering if that's a possibility. And I've also seen in workplace literature in a lot of contracts prohibitions to disclosing salaries. And I was wondering if that's legal.
Well, I can't quite speak to your latter question, though.
I can.
Oh, you can, Frank?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's illegal for them to do that. You have a right at any moment.
It's illegal for them to forbid us to disclose our salary.
Exactly. That would be considered discussing working wages and working conditions, which you're legally allowed to talk about at any point, as long as you're allowed to talk, like while you're at work on the clock, as long as you're allowed to talk about things that don't pertain directly to the work. If there are restrictions in your workplace about talking about things that don't pertain to work, so you can't talk about sports, you can't talk about the weather, you can't talk about politics, then they can restrict that. But they can't restrict it if you're on break, and they can't restrict it if you're outside of work.
Leslie, did you say that is in a contract that you saw for a union contract?
Temporary work is not unionized, mm-hmm. but it's been in the guidebook for jobs, where they'll say that a condition of employment here is that you do not discuss with any other employee your salary.
Yeah, Frank's correct then. I just wanted to qualify and make sure that wasn't a contract. There's vastly different regulation.
Okay, no, it was just in office rule books.
Speaking to your temporary position in itinerancy, we actually the IWW just had a representative speak at the Labor Notes Troublemakers School recently that was put on by a lot of left agitators within the trades, and we specifically spoke about itinerancy and part-time work in the workplace. And for us, like, it is difficult. Partially, I feel the reason that trade unions don't want to organize part-time workers is because they feel like they think it's not a good enough investment. A lot of times those are the first workers to get fired, et cetera. And that's real, but more importantly to us, like, we're not here just to make some investment on workers. We're here to support workers. Again, organize the worker, not the work. And so for us, like, that's why we have that motto, because, yeah, perhaps, like, it may be impossible at the time being to guarantee jobs of part-time workers the way you can of, like, a full-time worker that has, like, a vested interest in contract. But what you can do is create organizers amongst those part-time workers that then can create movement to try to do far more in-work agitation and solidarity unionism. So someone gets fired, you bring direct action to the floor, you get their job back. You know, you fight for that. You fight around those things. And I mean, to that end, that's the way in which our union looks at these models of part-time work. But more importantly, this is actually even a model now that you hear, as I said, about, like, these people in the trades, them starting to talk about. Because clearly, with so many people in part-time and itinerant work now, we no longer have the ability to just say, oh, only full-time workers, because eventually there's not going to be many full-time workers.
Right. Thank you.
Thank you, Leslie, for calling in. I think that that is a really great point about or that helps bring in, I think, what Frank was talking about in terms of shrinking the economy. And, you know, if you had been to Gar Alperovitz's talk at Powell's recently, you would have heard some of this too, that, you know, especially in kind of the cooperative movement, part of the idea is making sure that there are jobs for everyone, which is, you know, in part a matter of bringing down work time to spread the work around, which is kind of a popular phrase in the union. Ash, I wanted to turn to you and talk a little bit more about the intro class and what people can expect from it, what they can go to it hoping to get out of it.
Yeah, the intro class will, you know, kind of explain a brief history of the IWW and where it came out of, and talk about the differences between us and the trade unions, the business unions, and what we have in common. Talk about concepts of solidarity unionism, industrial organizing, and kind of get people ready for, you know, going to an organizing training. Answer questions. There's a lot of, you know, Q&A. So it should be fun.
I was.
Well, we have another caller on the line, so let's go in and talk to Mike for a moment. Mike, what's up?
Hey, how you doing? Hey, good talk. I think along the lines of diminishing the kind of the economy and everybody's personal input into that economy and spreading the wealth and all that kind of stuff, I think there's also intermediate solutions that are like my daughter's a nurse and she works 3-10s or 3-12s, and so she gets complete benefit package. She gets all of her stuff as she's kind of moving along, and I think people are going to start to kind of, as we move into these new economies, I think they're going to be higher labor economies because they're going to be lower profits per all. You know, you're going to get less wages, you're going to get less things, but what you really want is those you know, kind of benefits, and you want some kind of retirement, and you want all of those things along the thing. So those are going to have to uniform, and those are going to have to be able to apply to that part-time world. And like I said, it doesn't have to be less than 20 hours. It could be people who play like in the 20 to 30 hour range, and they get complete packages. They donate to a full things. The hours also economy, you start to play with like the 24-hour day, you know, where you split it up into 3-8s, you split it up into 2-12s, you know, and then the workplaces themselves start to accommodate to those things too. And I'd like to see your opinions on those.
Well, I don't know that I have an opinion right off about that. I think that what you're pointing out is important in the sense that the IWW isn't just its own kind of package program that is, you know, going to step in and you're going to do things exactly like the IWW. It's about worker autonomy. It's about really the rank and file of all industries figuring this stuff out. And that means that workers have to step up and when they're in their industries and find these, maybe not weak points, but these pivot points for more progressive change.
So that's, I mean, that kind of gets to the what Joe's saying, gets to the idea of direct democracy and how that looks, what the role of that is in unions and in society at large. We talk a lot about democracy. What real democracy do we have? I mean, the referendums that we have in Oregon are the only direct democracy that we've got, and even that's pretty indirect because who has the money to get the measure put on the ballot in the first place?
Who enforces it?
But so the, you know, the way the IWW works is really great because it's very directly democratic. There is no hierarchy. There is no union president that dictates what decisions can be made, what is allowed, what should happen. There are people that have more experience whose voices might be heard more readily than others who have less experience. But the purpose is for everybody to build together and have equal input into making decisions. And so that's regardless of how good of an organizer you are, or if what your gender, sexual orientation, or race might be.
We have another caller on the line. Joanne, thank you for calling in.
Well, you know, I guess I'm coming from the Bangladesh incidents and garment workers. And I don't know if anybody can answer this, but I just happen to think about it. The military uniforms of the U.S. government, the U.S. Military, does anyone know, are these military uniforms and that made in this country or made in other countries? Anyway, I appreciate your program. Thank you.
Jill, you want to field that?
I don't know that, but I do, you know, like that you bring that up because I think it relates to the other caller's, you know, comment about a shrinking economy and American economy and all this stuff. And something to, you know, I want people to note is that, you know, a lot of the things we have are on the backs of other people in other countries. And something, you know, to also note is that, you know, we're the industrial workers of the world. And we do have, you know, branches all over the world. There's actually a branch that just started up in Uganda. And I think, you know, it's something to keep in mind, which is that, you know, it's not just about issues going on in America. It's about all the issues. And Bangladesh is a perfect example of that, which is, you know, all these workers that are making all these clothes and stuff. And they've had all these terrible working conditions, and also that they are coming out in mass numbers to make changes about this. And we should be supporting that and showing solidarity to them.
I think that something that gets brought up often with the circumstances in Bangladesh, and even by some people who are supposedly represent Bangladeshi labor organizations, it seems kind of odd because they're like, no, don't boycott, don't boycott. And while I'll respect that opinion, I disagree with that fundamentally. And it's not a boycott because the conditions are bad. From my position, it's like, why are we buying clothes from around the world in those conditions? Like, they say that 80% of the exports of Bangladesh are clothing. Well, it hasn't always been that way. Their economy has not always been based around terrible factory work that's, you know, in miserable conditions. Their economy shouldn't have to be based on our consumerism. You know, we should be able to get away from that. If we want clothing, then we should be able to make it a lot closer to home, you know, where we have more of a connection. It makes more sense. When you allow a system of globalization where you can buy things from any part of the world, you can move a factory around at any minute, then inevitably workers are going to be exploited in every single one of those places. As soon as the Bangladeshi workers actually start to get better wages, that work's going to move somewhere else. It's going to move to Kenya. It's going to move to Niger. It's going to move to the Congo. I mean, it doesn't matter where. It's going to go somewhere. It'll move to Kazakhstan. I mean, it's going to move to the next place, and they're going to get exploited there, and it's just a carousel.
I want to get this last caller that I know we have on the line before the show wraps up. Jack, thank you for calling in.
Yeah. I sometimes have a little trouble relating simply because I'm self-employed and everybody I know is self-employed. So can you hear me there?
I can hear you just fine.
Okay, good. I wasn't sure. But nevertheless, the big problem, of course, as you pointed out, is the global finance oligarchy. Basically, they're running everything, and we got to shut them down. The way to get at them to get their money is the Wall Street sales tax. That will do more than just about any other idea that I've heard. The Wall Street sales tax on all investment turnover on Wall Street. Okay, that's my 2 cents worth.
Well, thank you. I think that, you know, in an ideal world, that is not entirely incompatible with what the IWW advocates, which is worker control of industry and leveraging power for that. I just want to quickly touch on some events that are coming up tonight and in the following week. Tom?
Yeah, obviously today we have the May Day March. I don't know if someone could quick speak to the details of the May Day March, maybe at
O'Brien Square. 2 p.m. is going to be tabling. 3 p.m. is the rally. 4 p.m. is the march.
And then after the march, over at the Red and Black Cafe, which is a IWW closed shop cafe, we're all union members, we're going to be having a night of revelry with four different musical acts. There is going to be Howlin' Wild, a folk band. There's going to be Speaker Minds, a hip-hop funk band. There's going to be Love Bomb Go-Go, a marching band. And there's going to be Hang the Old Year, a post-rock band, in between which we'll probably have some casual discussion about organizations and some different things that are going on in our community. And that is free. It's donation.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have for today. I've been Joe Clement. I've been talking with Frank, Tom, and Jill of the Industrial Workers of the World for KBOO. Thank you.
Anywhere beneath the sun, yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong. Solidarity forever. Us in the serfdom and would crush us with his might. Is there anything left to us but to organize and fight? For the union makes us strong.
You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 100.7 FM Corvallis in Albany. The time is 10 o'clock straight up. Coming up next is Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre.
The 2013 Yogathon is here, and KBOO is a co-sponsor. Living Yoga is holding its fourth annual Yogathon during the months of April and May. Individuals and groups are creating their own personal yoga challenges. They're attending classes at several participating yoga studios in the Portland area, and friends and family are sponsoring their efforts. Living Yoga is awarding prizes to the top individual and team. All of this is to help benefit Living Yoga, a nonprofit program bringing yoga to people in drug and alcohol recovery, incarceration, or who are accessing community transitional services. More information about this six-week-long event can be found at living-yoga.org.
KBOO is a proud media sponsor of the 23rd annual Reach the Beach, scheduled for Saturday, May 18th. With the finish line in Pacific City, Reach the Beach offers four different starting locations. You can ride 100 miles from Portland, 80 from Newburgh, 55 from Amity, or 28 miles from Grand Ronde. More information on deadlines and registration for Reach the Beach can be found on our website at kboo.fm.
Good morning. morning, Cascadia. Today is Wednesday, May Day, 2013. You're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, KBOO.FM on the web, the only station in the Bayou region that regularly reports on labor issues. Here in Portland, an unpermitted march is planned to start at Terry Schrunk Plaza at noon. Why is that a news story? Because if it's permitted, it's a parade, not a protest. Last year's May Day actions in Seattle resulted in a few broken windows and some dubious charges. Ironically, just after May Day 2013, those activists were arrested that back then, a year ago in Seattle, are going to trial. And if you buy your own health insurance, you are about to find out just exactly how badly you are going to be soaked next year by some of the reforms, which indeed were so corrupted by forces in Congress that they do not resemble reforms at all. And Russell Mulkey-Barath in Corporate Crime is going to be with us talking about corporate crime and how it is a necessary adjunct to the corporatization of the U.S. and indeed the world. And if you don't think that's a happening game, just have a look at the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, and see how that is going to look when it rolls out. First this, though, from the National Weather Service. Today, patchy fog early on. You may have noticed that. It's probably been and gone by now. Otherwise, a sunny day with highs near 71, perfect for an unpermitted protest. Northeast winds, 5 to 10 miles per hour, clear tonight. And the low around 45, still breezy for tomorrow. Again, clear sailing with a high near 78. And tomorrow night, clear starry skies with a low around 48 and not much in the way of a breeze. Our alternative forecast for today, it's a last quarter root moon in Capricorn. The synodic forecast, they say it's not a good time to be sowing anything in the garden. Ah, you see that? It's a waning moon. So instead, use the time to weed and harvest from the garden. It's a good time to start a compost heap, new one, little one, close to where you're going to be using it. A biodynamic outlook moon in Capricorn, it's in a sign, so go for those root plants. The sidereal side of the garden has this, the moon in Capricorn, that suggests potatoes and tubers planted will have strong growth. And that's it for both the alternative and our traditional forecasts. Now we're going to, before we get into some of the local issues, this is May Day 2013, and it may very well, when we look back, be one of those pivotal moments. Russell Mulkey-Barath is the editor of Corporate Crime Reporter. Many listeners are probably very familiar with this. It's organizing the Corporate Crime Report is organizing a conference. Russell just wrote the piece, "The Failure to Prosecute Corporate Crime Undermines U.S. Justice," for Reuters. Before we speak with Russell, welcome to the KBOO Airwaves. Imagine you are driving down the highway at 90 miles per hour where the posted speed limit is 55. As a result of your speeding, you lose control of your vehicle. You